Today is Monday, January 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington.
And I'm Jackson Bungani. Coming up, as China's deadly coronavirus spreads further, so do rumors and panic.
People don't have enough information, and I don't know whether that's because the government is holding the information back or whether because the government doesn't have the information themselves.
Also ahead on the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz death camp, how one Jewish family remembers the Holocaust. It's all on today's International Edition. Our top story today, China's deadly coronavirus is spreading more rapidly and widely, with more than 2,700 confirmed cases in China and 81 deaths. But as the virus spreads, so does uncertainty, fear, and confusion. To find out how people in China are coping amid the outbreak, I spoke earlier today with a journalist in Shanghai who visited the epicenter of the outbreak in Wuhan last Wednesday, the day before authorities put the city on lockdown. The journalist is anonymous to avoid retribution from authorities.
It was very deserted, the city. Like, everyone who you saw was wearing masks. Most of the shops and restaurants were closed. There wasn't many people on the streets or a lot of cars on the streets. But, you know, it's hard to say whether that was related to the virus or not, because it's also Chinese New Year at the moment, and all cities in China kind of empty out for Chinese New Year. So, you know, I couldn't really tell whether that was to do with the virus or not. But I spoke to some people on the streets, and most people were, you know, fairly relaxed about the situation. They were saying, yeah, we think it's serious, but everyone's being very careful. Everything seems to be under control. Like, they've shut down the market. It's all okay. But at the same time, I'm in a couple of WeChat groups for expats in Wuhan. And at the same time, there was a lot of rumors going around in these groups. And actually, as I was preparing to leave Wuhan on the Wednesday night, the night before the shutdown, there were already rumors saying they're going to shut the whole city down, that they're canceling flights, they're canceling trains. And this is before the official announcement, which actually came in the middle of the night.
Did you get a sense that people were well informed about what was going on and that there was actual flow of information to the people from health officials?
Most Chinese people who I spoke to said, bu lao jie, like, we don't understand, like, we don't understand it. And yeah, that was the case when I was speaking to people before the shutdown, and it's definitely the case now. People don't have enough information, and I don't know whether that's because the government is holding the information back or whether because the government doesn't have the information themselves. Like, no one really seems to understand the virus at the moment and how it spread, how quickly it spread, how potentially deadly it is.
Since you've come back to Shanghai, you mentioned that you have still been in touch with people in Wuhan. How has it changed for them? I mean, have they said that there are any differences now, or have you noticed a change in their attitude or their outlook on things?
Yeah, they're getting more and more frustrated, more paranoid, I think. There's just not enough information. There's a lot of conflicting information. This group is just constantly sharing messages and updates and rumors to the point where, you know, you don't look at your phone for 2 hours and you've missed 500 messages. It's impossible to keep up with. And everyone, you know, everyone's inside their houses, unable to leave. They can't even, like, really go to the supermarket. They don't know when they're going to start work. They don't know, you know, if they're going to get evacuated. They don't know if their kids are safe. And yeah, people are getting really bored, really frustrated, and quite worried.
Is there worry in Shanghai as well? How are people who are in Shanghai, because there have been cases in Shanghai, how are people there dealing with this outbreak?
People are worried. From a friend of mine, her husband's company has evacuated their entire family and all of the foreign staff. I've got other friends who have young babies and they're leaving. And yeah, there's a lot of panic as well online and in the WeChat groups, people sharing information, sharing rumors. The problem is there's just not really enough official information out there on the situation. And also there's a problem with trust. Like, people don't necessarily trust what the government is telling them. The worry is that they've taken these extreme measures because the situation is actually worse than they're leading people to believe. And this is the paranoia that's spreading around the community.
That was a journalist in Shanghai, China, kept anonymous for her safety. While the outbreak spirals inside China, nearly 50 cases, but no deaths, have also been confirmed outside the country, mostly involving Chinese tourists or people who visited Wuhan recently. The vast majority of cases outside China have been in Asia and Australia, but the U.S. has also had 5 cases, and on Sunday, Europe confirmed its first 3 cases, all in France. To learn how Europe is confronting the outbreak, earlier today, I spoke with journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris.
Well, so far, the 3 of them, they're doing well. They have no fever. That was very important for French authorities to mention that. We know that one in Bordeaux is doing well, and it might do a press conference very soon. The 2 cases in Paris, it's a couple. They arrived from Wuhan last week, the husband and wife, and they were not sick when they left China and when they arrive in Paris.
Anything special being put in place to monitor people coming from China or to monitor people in France or anywhere else in the EU?
So far, it is important to mention that you have cases in Europe only in France. It is true that several European countries, they are monitoring the situation at the borders, especially at airports. But so far, you have only 3 confirmed cases in France. So right now what they're doing, and especially the French government, has been criticized for not screening people at the airport, especially in Charles de Gaulle in Paris, where until Sunday morning there were no temperature taken at the airport from passengers arriving from China. So right now you have a medical team at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris. I think what's important right now for European government, especially for the French one, is to repatriate French citizens who are currently in Wuhan. The French government with Chinese authorities, they're trying to organize a huge operation by next week to be able to bring back about 800 French citizens trapped in Wuhan. Let's also mention that the Spanish government is also trying to organize something to organize a repatriation flight of its own citizens.
What about everyday citizens in France? I mean, is this a great concern that people have, or is this sort of in the background?
It has an impact for sure. On Sunday, celebrations for the Chinese New Year's Eve was canceled in Paris, for example, because of that epidemic. Also, it is important that you have more and more calls, 911 calls, for people trying to have a concern and asking questions to the health authorities to say, for example, hey, I went to a Chinese restaurant yesterday. Is that okay? We have that kind of ridiculous question and concerns. And French authorities, they're trying to tell people, to tell the citizens, you know, it's okay to be concerned, but, I mean, you can go to a Chinese restaurant. You can eat Chinese food. That's okay. You have also something to me that's really telling is that in Chateau de Versailles, in the Versailles Castle, people welcoming tourists in this big touristic attraction in Paris. Local employees, now they have masks when they welcome people. So, I mean, you can see there's not a huge fear among citizens, but you can see from time to time that it has an impact.
That was VOA's Nicolas Pinault in Paris.
U.S. President Donald Trump's lawyers resumed their impeachment defense today as Democratic Party leaders issue fresh calls for new witnesses in the Senate trial. Their new demands were prompted by reports that Trump then told his then national security advisor that he wanted to withhold security aid to Ukraine until it launched an investigation into the Democratic rival. And for more on this, we are joined by VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, so Catherine, let's start with this bombshell. They're calling it the Bolton bombshell. According to unpublished manuscript of Bolton's forthcoming book, that President Trump, in a conversation held last summer with Bolton, that he was trying, he wanted to hold up military assistance into, you know, calling for an investigation into Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden. How big is this development?
Well, this is huge. I think that we use the word bombshell in terms of breaking news quite a bit here in the United States, but this story really does merit it. When it broke here on Sunday night, it came as a shock to everyone. And what it really did was reaffirm what congressional Democrats have been calling for since last fall. They've been trying to get Bolton in to testify. They've been pushing for his testimony, not only in the Senate impeachment trial, but earlier during the House impeachment investigation. This reaffirms, from their perspective, the need to get him in into the Senate trial as a witness to testify to what he heard and saw.
Now, the president's legal team will lay out their case today, and it appears that this revelation undercuts a key portion of their legal defense. Does this make it harder for Republican senators to acquit the president without calling for witness or, you know, witness testimony?
Well, not necessarily so. If you listen to Republican senators as they react to the news this morning. Now, we do have a couple of Republicans, namely Mitt Romney and Susan Collins, who are already thought of as outliers, who could vote for witnesses in the Senate impeachment trial, calling for Bolton to come in and testify. But others are saying that this really doesn't change their mind, or they're saying they want to take a look at this unpublished manuscript, or they say that they need to wait and hear more from the White House counsel as they lay out their case today. So really, when you look at the bulk of the Republican Senate, this isn't moving the needle all that much.
And how has the White House reacted to this, bombshell report?
Well, as usual, President Trump took to Twitter. And what's really interesting is that when he said that Bolton was lying about those conversations, he actually may have hurt himself in terms of claiming executive privilege, which, of course, is the right that presidents have over some conversations to keep them secret. But the fact that he's out there tweeting about those conversations means that he's not claiming executive privilege over them. So he's kind of taking two steps forward when he comes out and says these things.
Right. And, real quick, Catherine, how is the rest of the week going to look like?
Well, we'll hear at least two more days of opening arguments from the president's defense team. Then senators will get to ask their questions during 16 hours set aside for that element of the trial. And then we'll have that all-important vote on whether witnesses can be called in.
That was VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. Catherine, thank you very much. This is VOA's International Edition.
Among the top stories in the world, two protesters were shot dead by unidentified gunmen in Iraq who attacked the main protest camp in the southern city of Nasiriyah late Sunday as security forces began a crackdown on anti-government demonstrations that have lasted months. And in The Gambia, police arrested 137 people amid protests calling for the president to step down after 3 years in power. Security forces used tear gas Sunday to break up the thousands of demonstrators. President Adama Barrow said he would only lead for 3 years when he was elected in 2017, but now says he wants to rule for five. And in Libya, the head of the state oil firm warned Monday that if the international community tolerates an ongoing blockade on the country's oil industry, it would be complicit in ending the rule of law in the country. This is International Edition.
President Donald Trump is set to discuss details of his much-delayed Middle East peace plan during meetings with Israeli leaders at the White House. Trump will host Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and opposition leader Benny Gantz, the leaders who will be facing off in March for the third Israeli general election in a year. And VOA's White House correspondent Steve Harmon joins us from the White House. Hello, Steve.
Yes, good afternoon.
Talk to us about the contours of this peace plan. We saw earlier reporting on this say that the plan would give Israel sovereignty over the Jordan Valley along the border with Jordan, as well as over Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Is that correct?
We have absolutely nothing from the White House on the record or on background about the details of that. Just a few minutes ago, President Trump in the Oval Office with Netanyahu said that details of this plan, which he also called a suggestion, would be released at 12 noon tomorrow when he will have an event in the East Room with the Israeli Prime Minister.
Now, President Trump recently said that his administration had consulted or spoken to Palestinians and will continue speaking to them beforehand about this plan. The president saying, quote, they may react negatively at first, but it is actually positive for them. Is this a sign that the plan might be a hard sell for Palestinians who say that, you know, if it does not give them a state in all of West Bank or Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, that this is a non-starter?
Yes, so if you talk to any mainstream analyst on the Middle East, they'll tell you that the fact that the Palestinians have not been involved in the process of formulating this does essentially make it a dead on arrival. But what it may lead to is talking points. But, you know, even the president seems hesitant, as in his remarks a few minutes ago, to just refer to this as a peace plan, more of a suggestion, hoping that that might at some point get the Palestinians to at least talk about it. But there's a lot of criticism of what little we know about this, the fact that the Palestinians essentially have not been consulted.
Right. And, Steve, the two Israel leaders, Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, will be facing off in an election in March. Who does this plan help politically at home?
Well, I think that's a question you've got to ask Israeli political analysts. In a way, it could be helping both of them because, you know, Netanyahu, for his base, has that photo opportunity again, presenting this alongside the president. But Gantz is also being recognized as a potential successor to Netanyahu and has been invited here to meet with the president as well. So something definitely for his camp to take back home with them.
That was VOA's White House correspondent Steve Hammond joining us from the White House. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
This is Science in a Minute.
People have long linked stress to gray hair. Now a new Harvard University-led study describes why this happens. After proposing several theories they couldn't validate, the Harvard investigators turned their attention to the sympathetic nerve system, which controls our body's fight-or-flight response. They found that these nerves spread into hair follicles on the skin, and that stress can cause these nerves to release a hormone that is absorbed by stem cells that convert to pigment or color cells for new hair follicles. The researchers say this hormone stimulates the stem cells to convert into too many pigment cells, essentially draining the supply of stem cells that were to generate color for future hair follicles. They say that once these pigment-producing cells are gone, it's not possible to regenerate anymore. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, this is Larry London inviting you to join me on February 14th. For Border Crossings presents Urban Chart Legends. Some of the biggest names in urban music, jazz, R&B, hip-hop. It's all on one program on one day, February 14th. Michael Jackson, Kendrick Lamar, James Brown, and many more. Tune us in starting at 1500 Universal right here on The Voice of America.
On this day 75 years ago, Soviet Union soldiers liberated the Auschwitz death camp in Poland, where over a million people, mostly Jews, were systematically murdered by the Nazis. Ever since, Holocaust survivors, their descendants, and supporters have reminded the world to never forget the horrors of the Holocaust and the evil that humans everywhere are capable of. VOA's Adam Phillips has this report on how one Jewish family, whose matriarch survived Auschwitz, keeps the memory of the Holocaust alive.
Oded Ravek, now 64, was born 10 years after his mother Livia and her two sisters were freed from Auschwitz and began the long trek that eventually led them to the State of Israel. but Ravik says his parents' memories of the Holocaust were a constant underlying presence in their otherwise happy home.
They told us about the hard labor, about the clothing. You know, they were youngsters. My mom was a teenager. And all of a sudden, she found herself in a cattle cart. She couldn't move. And she thought she'll wake up and it will be over. But it was reality. And the German shepherd dogs and the SS shouting and the scene must have looked like insane. And then having them all tattooed and the removal of the humanity and the clothing that they have to take off. My mom explained you know, to us in detail how ashamed they all were, you know, that the Germans were laughing and kicking and cursing. It was a terrible experience as one could ever have.
Ravik says the experience still haunts his mother at night, even at the age of 93. Still, he has never viewed his mother as a victim.
I always saw her as a heroine and could never understand how she could smile, how she could raise a family and have good humor and live a long and very fulfilling life with this hanging over her head, knowing that when night comes, it always takes her back to Auschwitz, and then the next morning she's cheerful and happy.
The realities of Auschwitz came to Ravik when he and his wife and children and other relatives traveled with his mom to the camp, which is now a museum. That's when he got the idea to get his own tattoo bearing the number inked into his mother's arm. It was a way to honor her and her fading generation and to offer a visible reminder of the Holocaust to others.
My mom, may she be well, is just turned 93, and that generation is dwindling, so many deniers out there. I had many people stop me and ask me, what is the number? You would think in this day and age people would know about the Holocaust, but I explained to them why I have the number. You know, I'm talking to people about the events that happened, not only to my mom, but to a whole lot of Jews from all over Europe.
Radek's son, Amir, is one of several family members who have followed his father's example. Amir says his tattoo has often given him strength during hard times.
You know, a lot of times, like, life hits you down, whether, like, financially, whether emotionally, and like, sometimes, you know, I really do want to give up, and I don't want to continue. Life's tough. And so when I think of, like, what my grandma went through, and then what I personally go through, nothing really in life seems that big. No problem seems too tough. You know, you've never seen anything in your life that compares. So it really brings me to a place where, like, I'm so grateful to be alive, and how lucky I am to exist.
While the world remembers Auschwitz on this day, Oded Ravik says his mother lives it every day. For him, it's a time to wonder if the truth of the Holocaust has prompted humans to be kinder and more tolerant and understanding of each other. Ravik admits to being both slightly optimistic and deeply skeptical. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
You're listening to International Edition. Basketball fans around the world are mourning the death of Kobe Bryant, one of the greatest basketball players of his generation, who during a 20-year career with the Los Angeles Lakers won 5 championships. Kobe, who was 41 years old, died in a helicopter crash in Calabasas, California. Kobe's 13-year-old daughter Gianna was among the helicopter's 8 other passengers who were all confirmed dead. AP's Oscar Wells Gabriel has more.
As one fan, Rene Sotomayor, put it,
a lot of people are saying today's the day that part of L.A. died.
And indeed, the scene in the plaza near the Staples Center took on the kind of mournful scene reminiscent of what happened when Michael Jackson died in 2009. People lit candles, displayed memorabilia, and talked about the shock. Julie Sierra noted,
for the amount of people that are out here, it's silent. Everybody's in grief. Everybody's mourning.
Even so, some fans paid tribute to Bryant as though they were still inside the Staples Center watching him play. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
Reuters reports that a growing investigation into the helicopter crash that killed Kobe Bryant will include the FBI and focus primarily on weather conditions and potential mechanical issues. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Dan Brown. Our engineer has been John Drayden. I'm Jackson Vunganyi, together with my co-host, Jason Patinkin. Have a great day, everyone.